And I got 400 million things to do and kind of no motivation to do any of them. I don't know if you ever had that problem.
On a Friday afternoon before a holiday weekend, all the time.
Hi, everybody. Hey, this is Todd Conklin. It's a pre-accident podcast investigation. No, pre-accident. I can't even say the name of the podcast. Pre-accident investigation podcast. Thank you. Okay, you want to start again? Hi, everybody. I'm Todd Conklin, the host of the pre-accident podcast, and you're dialed into an afternoon worth of fun. Yes, that's, oh no, it's not that. Let's see. What do I have? Summer is here, baby. And by the time you hear this, I'll bet you a nickel I will be on some kind of exotic wild river cruise. Starting in Amsterdam, I'm taking four 83-year-old people, because one is not enough, two is too easy, three is an odd number, and four is the perfect number on a river cruise. And you know what? It's going to be fun. I promise you. I'll listen to this podcast to remind me of how much fun it's going to be. No, it'll be great. I'm happy and psyched to get the opportunity. And you know what? It's always fun. And it's something I know how to do. I know how to travel. I'm pretty good at getting a rental car, and I know where to stand for the fastest security line. And I'm pretty smart with being nice to the right people in the airline. You know, I got all that crap worked out a while ago, I guess. I got a bunch of other stuff I don't have worked out. My personal life is a mess. Well, no more messy than yours. I mean, so don't pity me, and I won't pity you. The world is filled with complex environments in which we have decided to spend our time. So, this is a pretty interesting conversation. So you guys are so good about writing me emails and telling me stuff and giving me hints. And I got an email that said, there's this guy you have got to interview because you will love him. And so I said, okay, I'm always looking for, especially this is a person I never even heard of before, so I'm super psyched about it. His name's Scott Gessinger, and he's got a book. I'm not going to say the name of his book, although I'm dying to. I'm dying to say it now. He's going to say, I make him say it at least twice, because it is the best named safety book in the history of all safety books, bar none. It is just, it's a great safety book. And Scott brings to our podcast conversation, at least, some pretty interesting, you're going to tell in a minute that he's an engineer. There's just no hiding it. I mean, you can just in a minute, although he does kind of make a secret confession towards the end, which you'll have to listen to. But we have a really long, interesting discussion around the notion of risk. And I always think it's fun for a soft scientist and a hard scientist to discuss something like risk, because the perception for the hard scientist is that risk is knowable, and the perception for the soft science is that risk is entirely subjective. And so you know that there's kind of no middle ground there, right? And so we're going to have a big conversation and talk about it, and we do that. But eventually we sort of come to a point where it makes sense to transition into talking about risk and his new book. You're going to love Scott, and you're going to really like this podcast. It's pretty fun, actually. It's great. It's really great. Until then, I hope your summer's going well. I have not seen you hanging out, and I've been looking for you. I sure had a good time seeing everybody at HPRCT. It sounds like I made quite a few enemies. That's nice to know. I always forget that HPRC, because HPRCT strikes me as kind of an odd name for a conference. And it stands for Human Performance Root Cause Trending. I always forget that 3/5 of that name is root cause trending. And I think I made a comment about root cause. I think, in fact, what Sidney Decker and I said is that, isn't it interesting at every level that root causes have root causes, and that it's kind of an arbitrary abstraction. You know, in fact, we'll talk about it with Scott on this podcast, because engineers don't like that. It did not make me popular with people. I guess I got a little, what do they call them? Haters. I got some haters on LinkedIn. Fortunately for me and for the haters, I don't really know how to use LinkedIn, so I'm not that's kind of not a problem. So, you know, we can work with it that way somehow as well. But other than that, we can chat all day long. I had a great time seeing you guys at HPRCT. I had a really fun time seeing you in the trips with Decker. I've really enjoyed seeing people. It's so much fun to get back together with you. I miss you because you're so dang fun. That's what I do, is I miss you. So let me quit yammering on here and get into the podcast. Will you please sit back and relax and listen as you hear Scott Gessinger, and he's going to talk about a lot of stuff, risk and reward and excitement and safety and the journey we've been on for a while. So here we go. This is Scott's conversation with me.
Sure. Well, I am a safety engineer. I've worked in safety for 17 years, graduate of the University of Minnesota Duluth program. And I've throughout my career, I've had a few different experiences and positions where, you know, I worked for a consulting company. I've worked in loss control for insurance. I've worked in the manufacturing settings. I've had roles that were more oriented to a single facility, roles that have been oriented to more of a corporate view, and all of that kind of coming together, I think, is nice because it gives me a pretty well-rounded ability to view the different aspects of professional safety out there, and the ability to, for lack of a better term, to empathize with what safety professionals at different levels are going through on their day-to-day basis.
So what are you doing now?
Right now, I am a safety engineer at a tech company, and I am writing on the side. So that's what I do to stay busy in the evenings when I'm not playing with my 4-year-old.
Having fun, doing great things, exciting things.
Absolutely.
Excellent. That's good. So how do you define safety? As a safety engineer with lots of applied background who writes on the side and has fun with a 4-year-old, what's your definition of safety? How do you look at safety?
I look at safety first and foremost as an environment in which people can accomplish their goals within an acceptable window of risk.
How do you define acceptable window of risk? Of course, of course you got me on that. I mean, I'm sucked into the conversation now.
Well, good. Well, you know, that acceptable level of risk is different for everything that you do. I mean, if I'm playing football with my 4-year-old in the backyard, the acceptable level of risk is, you know, maybe a little boo-boo if he tackles me too hard and I scrape my elbow. The acceptable level of risk for a college football player could be, you know, bruises are okay as long as you don't get too bad of a concussion or break a bone. So that risk window really is dependent upon the overall goal and the reward. And, you know, when we try to apply that to a business model, which is really a tricky thing to do, there's this idea that we have a more, as businesses, there's a moral obligation not just to provide a safe workplace, but to provide jobs and to stimulate the economic growth of your region or country and your product. So that window of risk really is variable for every different situation.
When do you measure risk in this model? Do you measure it before an event happens, or do you measure it after a consequence takes place? Because it strikes me that this model of risk acceptability, it sounds great up until the time something happens. And then, yeah, as soon as something happens, clearly you had too high of an acceptance level of risk. A better worker would have stopped before the broken arm happened or whatever the outcome is.
Maybe. by saying there's an acceptable level of risk, you also have to say that you will accept events that happen within that window. So every time you get onto an airplane to fly to a conference or go visit a client, you are accepting a level of risk that there's a one in X million chance that your aircraft will break apart. Now, at the time that the aircraft is breaking apart, you're obviously thinking, well, this sucks, I should have driven. But within that, there has to be a conversation of, can we even, is it even possible to narrow this risk down further? And what's the reward? A firefighter going into a building has an acceptable level of risk. That firefighter knows that that there is a risk of going into the building, and they have to weigh the risk versus the reward. And that at some point, when something happens within that risk window, we have to accept it. Now, the trick there is, if we can't narrow the window anymore, can we at least reduce the consequences? So, for instance, you're on that airplane that breaks apart. Can we build the airplane in such a way that if it breaks apart, the passengers have a higher likelihood of surviving that event? If the firefighter runs into the building and the building collapses, can we design his gear so he or she has a greater chance of survival of that event?
But doesn't the risk owner and then the organization have different levels of acceptability? I mean, I would think that as a performer, and based upon my experience, confidence, optimism, bias, I mean, there's a lot going on in my head, I accept risk all the time. But as an organization, I don't know if I'm willing to say I want to accept risk. In fact, I think as an organization, I'm probably motivated to have the least amount of risk and the highest amount of productivity I can have. How does it work for an organization?
For an organization, you have to factor in profitability and you have to factor in other risks. So if you have narrowed your window of risk down to a certain point and an incident occurs in there, and you dump all kinds of resources into narrowing that window further, but there's other wider windows of risk, now you're doing a disservice to your employees because you're not looking at those other windows of risk where just because of luck or chance, you haven't happened to have an incident yet.
Is all risk knowable? Is it possible? Like, how, define risk for me.
You know, that's a tough one. I don't know if all risk is knowable. And I would, as far as the definition of risk, I would, I'd want to look at the ISO standard and see how they define risk. But I would say, you know, it's the chance of a positive or negative occurrence or outcome from a situation.
My goodness, you're such an engineer. it just kind of shot out at me there, right there. Look at the ISO standard. How do you, for your own personal life, how do you assess risk? I mean, do you really look at frequency and potential like that?
As an individual human being, I probably do what most human beings do, and completely misjudge my personal risk. I think that's a common fault of all humans, is we don't judge risk correctly when we're judging it for ourselves. But I try to, what's a good way to state this? I in my personal life try to assess risk the same way that I try to eat, right? I don't go on diets, but I just try and make somewhat healthy decisions when I eat. So when I'm assessing risk, I may not, you know, I'm a woodworker and I've got my wood shop in the garage, and I may not guard everything to the nth degree, but I try to make reasonable steps or take reasonable steps to have that shop be a safe place for me to work.
So let me add one other just component, because of course I'm super fixated on this. I think the industry kind of sees risk as permanent. That if you identify risk, you mitigate for that risk, you plan, program, train, proceduralize, you can manage risk pretty well administratively. But in fact, I would suggest the notion of risk being permanent is seductive, but incredibly inaccurate. That risk is really fluid.
Oh,
that it moves in and out, that it's constantly in motion, that risks appear and disappear in the process of doing work. How do we handle that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And it's something that I know when I do risk assessments, one of the things that I try to coach people on who I'm doing the risk assessments with, or who I'm training to do risk assessments, is that we're trying to get a general idea. We're not drawing a thin line where on the left of the line is risk, on the right side of the line is safety. We're drawing a thick line, and there's quite a bit of overlap between risk and safety, and that line is going to wiggle and it's going to vibrate and it's going to move depending on what we're doing. And what's acceptable or not acceptable may even change depending on what we're doing.
With all of this information around risk, risk acceptance, understanding and managing risk, what do we do with it? What do we do with that information? What does a guy running a company do with everything you just talked about?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because I think there's a lot that you can do with it, but I also think you can over apply it. You know, for instance, you can take what you've learned about risk and you can apply that to your insurance management and help estimate what you should have for deductibles and stuff like that. You can apply it to setting your safety goals for the company. I think it's good for that. I think you can also apply it in such a manner to determine if an aspect of business is acceptable to you or not. So, for instance, if you work at a company that is a construction company, you could use that risk assessment to say that we think it's too risky to use cranes over this height, so we're going to contract that out to somebody who's more of an expert.
See, and that's really interesting too, because now you're getting into the fact that risk is really transportable, that I can pay somebody to accept my risk, or maybe even more interestingly, there are people who will actually take my money and take my risk. And I think that model's probably good organizationally. It's a little bit classically actuarial. To me, where I think this gets to be an interesting question is, how does this apply to the individual performer, to a person doing a job in the field, interfacing with, you know, real work, real time, in a really complex environment with real variability?
Yeah.
That's where that gets interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's important to honestly share with employees, here's what we have determined your risk level is, and you should know this, because if you're getting paid X amount to do this job, you need to be comfortable with your window of risk and your personal risk reward balance on this. And it can be difficult because, like I said earlier, as human beings, we're terrible, terrible at judging our own individual risk factors.
I think we're probably okay. I think we just have a really strong bias towards optimism, that we favor sort of living through the plane ride as opposed to thinking about dying in the plane ride. And I think that bias towards optimism is healthy. I mean, it's what gets you out of bed. But I think that's really interesting. Talk to me about your new book. Does your new book really discuss this kind of stuff?
Well, the new book is primarily meant to be a discussion of the last 80 years that have shaped professional safety and the fact that we need to evolve past that. It looks a lot at issues like Heinrich and his research, and it looks at behavior-based safety, and it argues that it's time for us to move on. When Heinrich did his research, child labor was still legal.
You're giving Heinrich so much benefit. You are so nice and kind to Heinrich right there. That's amazing.
Well, you should read the book. You might feel differently. but one of the things that I tried to do with the book is I tried to write it in a manner that it's understandable for people who don't have a vast pre-existing safety knowledge, but there's value for people there who've been working in safety for a long time. And I also tried to write it so it's approachable and a little bit funny. A good example would be I've got a chapter in there where I wanted to compare and contrast Heinrich's ideas with application of Deming to safety. And I thought, how can I do this in a manner that's not really dry? So I wrote the chapter as if there were two ringside announcers calling a boxing match between Heinrich and Deming.
Wow, who wins? Oh, don't tell me.
Deming, of course.
Don't tell me. I want it to be a surprise. I want it to be a surprise.
I will tell you that it devolves into utter chaos by the end.
How's the book go? What a great idea to write a book. Well, that's a great book topic. Because there's so much there. I mean, in the journey, kind of the arc that safety's gone on, that must have been super interesting for you to look up and research and write.
Yeah, it really was. And as I was doing that, I was learning a lot. And thankfully, the things I learned about reinforced what my arguments were. You know, I thought about things like, okay, how do we apply management systems, and how do we argue that management systems have more of an effect than behavior does? Why does this notion of blaming safety failures on employee behavior hang on so tenaciously? And when you look through history and you think about the attitudes and who in our society has power and all of those things, you really start to see that placing the onus on employees to quit being such bad employees and sticking their hands in those darn machines that cut them off, that started at a time before workers' compensation. So employees, if they wanted to be compensated for an injury at work, had to sue their employer, and their employer could say, well, it was their fault. We told them not to do that, and they did it, and they got hurt. And if you look today, for people in leadership positions, there's still that temptation of, and it's probably not even a conscious temptation. It's probably in the subconscious, where it's so easy to say, well, I'm doing everything I can do as a manager. I told them not to do that, and they did it, and they still got hurt. So, you know, it's their fault. We don't have to put all these big expensive changes in, and I don't have to do the hard work of changing my management system.
And that efficiency is really interesting. How much of a role did Frederick Taylor play in your book?
That name doesn't even ring a bell.
Oh,
I don't
man.
Even know if
So let me turn Taylor. You on to Frederick Taylor. He's somebody really interesting. He wrote The Scientific Method of Managing Work. He wrote a paper in 1911 that basically said the managers are smarter than workers.
Wow.
So, and it really stuck. I mean, it stuck. If I don't know if you know this, Scott, but on the other side of the campus, there was a whole bunch of buildings that had the word humanities on them. You probably never went over there. There was also a cafeteria and girls. You engineers, I know that you tend to really favor one side of the campus, but on the other side of campus, and that whole notion of Taylorism, you just described it beautifully. I mean, you described beautifully kind of initially how the responses companies had historically were, you know, the worker is a back, not a brain. And if they're obedient and do as they're told, not only are they productive, but they'll live. What was the most interesting thing that came out of the book? What did you find most interesting?
The thing, gosh, I think, you know what? The most interesting thing would be that when I researched the Bhopal incident for a chapter, really learning in depth what happened with that incident and looking at the two causation theories and coming to the conclusion that no matter which causation theory was most probable, that it didn't matter because it was the management systems that led to all of the consequences of the Bhopal incident.
Isn't it weird how root causes always have root causes?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. It's really, it's a really cool thing.
It's very cool. So what's the name of the book and how do I get it?
The name of the book is The Fearless World of Professional Safety in the 21st Century.
Oh my gosh. That's the best book name ever. I love this book already. I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but that, my friend, is a great title. How did you come up with that title?
When I started writing the book, first of all, I need to tell you a deep, dark secret.
Yes, please do. Please blab away. College. No one is listening, so don't worry.
Okay, good. My undergraduate degree, I was a double major in psychology and sociology.
Oh my gosh, you did know that side of the campus. You had to hide that in engineering school, didn't you? You couldn't let on that you had that.
No, and you know, it's really funny because so I studied both the humanities side and the engineering side, and in looking at both of them equally, what I tell people over and over about professional safety is forget about behavior, design around it. Don't sit here and try and change behavior. Design something for somebody to make the biggest mistake you can possibly think of. And if that item is still safe in that case, you've done a good job designing it.
Man, what a beautiful thing to hear you say.
I'm glad to hear that.
That is perfect. Say that book name again. I want to hear it one more time. I love it that much.
The Fearless World of Professional Safety in the 21st Century.
That is amazing. That is amazing. What a fun conversation. Thanks for talking to me, man.
Yeah. Hey, thank you very much. Anytime. And after you've read the book, if you want to give me a call again, we can talk about anything that's in there, and I'll be happy to do so.
The Fearless World of Professional Safety in the 21st Century. If that doesn't have a carnival-themed kind of a Pulp Fiction cover on it, he's missing a stinking bet. Scott Gessinger, thank you for your conversation. And more importantly, thank you for listening. It is so dang much fun having you on board. Our numbers are gigantic. If we ever thought about, you know, like be the biggest podcast for safety, we've done it. No one's even, I mean, yeah, we've done it. It's now we have to think about other stuff, I think. Hey, if you haven't had a chance to pick up Workplace Fatalities, I got a really kind letter just the other day from a company thanking me for helping reinforce some ideas around building controls. They used the book to move a group that had a catastrophic failure away from basically asking the workers to be perfect to assuming that they would actually manage controls and verifications on the front end. It was very pleasing to me. I hope you've had a chance to read it. There's a lot of really interesting ideas in there, and it's somewhat controversial. I like the fact that it's kind of pissing people off. That is satisfying at some level. Because book writing is not very competitive. Like, you want everyone, like, I want Scott to sell 1 million books. That's fine. So I don't think of it as competition, really. So, hey, thanks for listening. Pick up a copy of the book if you can. I hope you get what you need. Learn something new every single day. I bet you did today. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.